All right. We're kind of in the book of Job, but I don't know that you want to turn there because we're really done with the book of Job. We finished it last week. And so I mentioned last week that I wanted to do one more final study, kind of wrapping up the things that we've been talking about in the book of Job. I'm calling it the epilogue. Isn't that what you're supposed to do when you write something after the book that's called the epilogue or something? It's like, how did it all turn out kind of stuff? So as we've been talking about, Job is the guy who's gone through the worst time that anyone could ever imagine. He lost his possessions. His children have died. His health has failed. And through the book, we've watched Job and his friends wrestle with the question, why? That's what the book's all about. Why is all this stuff happening? Why? And both Job and his friends actually have the same answer, but they just doesn't make sense to either of them. They're debating it all, but they really have the same idea that the only reason people go through difficult times is because they did something to deserve it. And we ask the same questions, don't we? You know, you lose your job, you end up in the hospital. Somebody, you know, a relationship breaks up. Some tragedy happens. And we ask ourselves, what did I do to deserve this, right? Isn't that what we ask? That's one of the first things that we all ask ourselves. And yet we've found through these last, I think it was April, May, June, July, August, 4 months we've been in this book. And we've come to the conclusion, it ain't that easy. It just ain't that easy. And one of the reasons we know it ain't that easy is because Job didn't do anything. From the very beginning of the book, God states that Job was a blameless man. It wasn't because, and we'll review what it was all about. Tonight I want to talk about two things. I've got two sections. It's kind of a topical study tonight. And there's two things I want to talk about. First, I want to talk about why do we go through trials? And I want to talk about how we survive trials. So that's kind of the two sections of the study I've got. For the first part, why trials, I think I've got 6 points. For the second part, I got 5 points. So we're going to kind of breeze through the points just to kind of wrap this all up. So first, why trials? Why do we go through trials? Again, I've got 6 things. The first one is correction. Now, even though we've already established, we know that Job didn't go through this because he did something wrong, there is truth in the idea that sometimes we do things that deserve difficulty. Maybe we're doing something we shouldn't, or we're looking where we shouldn't.
I'm a hot babe out jogging. I'm not making sure this stays a 10 when you drive by. You're checking out my awesome headband when... Oops. That's when you find out your cut rate insurance, it ain't paying for this. So get Allstate. Save cash and be better protected from mayhem, like me.
Mayhem is everywhere. So get an Allstate agent. Are you in good hands?
I just love those commercials. They're just the biggest crack up. So maybe you're like the guy in the car and you're looking where you shouldn't. You're looking at her headband. Yeah, that's what you notice, is the headband. There are times when indeed God is trying to correct the bad behavior of his kids. That is a legitimate reason. That is a very real thing. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 through 8, the writer says this, "Have you forgotten the encouraging words God spoke to you as his children? He said, my child, don't make light of the Lord's discipline and don't give up when he corrects you." And we mentioned this before. The writer of Hebrews is quoting the book of Job, Job chapter 5, verse 17. But what he's quoting one of Job's friends, those bad guys, the guys that got it all wrong. But it's true. It's still true. There are times when God corrects his children. For the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes each one he accepts as his child. As you endure this divine discipline, remember that God is treating you as his own children. Whoever heard of a child who is never disciplined by its father? If God doesn't discipline you as he does all of his children, it means that you're an illegitimate and you are not really his children at all. So, because God is our father, And when children misbehave, part of the duties of a father is to straighten your child out. Get them back on track. That's what we're supposed to do. That's what parents are supposed to be about. If you rob a bank and you're sitting in prison, don't ask yourself, why are these hard things happening to me? Because you robbed a bank, you idiot. You with me with this? You understand? There are times when hard things come directly because of our disobedience. And we shouldn't be asking ourselves, you know, why me? Poor me? Poor. No, you idiot. It's because you did something. Now, on the other hand, if there is nothing obvious, and you ask yourself that question that we all ask, why did I go through this? And you can't think of what it is. Well, then stop looking for it, because this isn't your reason. That's the whole point we've seen in the book of Job, is that if nothing pops out that's directly connected, now don't go down the road where, well, when I was 5 years old, I stole the neighbor's, you know, thing, you know, and this must be it. No, no. But if it's something that you've done that is directly connected to this thing, well, then yes. Then it may be that your difficulty is because of correction. Second, God is proud. And as we've talked about, this, what do I mean by this? This is the case with Job. God allowed Satan to cause trouble to Job, to show Satan and the whole universe what a godly man would do when difficult times come. God is proud of Job. In chapter 1, then the Lord asked Satan, have you noticed my servant Job? He is the finest man in all the earth. He is blameless, a man of complete integrity. He fears God and stays away from evil. And so that's why God allowed it, to show Satan that a man who trusts me will still trust me even with difficulty. Now, Job complained a whole lot. He did, but he still trusted God. Job 13:15. Job said, though he slay me, this is right in the middle, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. He's still going to trust him. As the Union Pacific Railroad was being constructed, an elaborate trestle bridge was built across a large canyon in the west. Wanting to test the bridge, the builder loaded a train with enough extra cars and equipment to double the normal payload. And then he sat the train in the middle of the bridge, and it stayed there an entire day. One of the workers said, are you trying to see if we can break the bridge? No, the builder said, I'm trying to prove that the bridge won't break. And that's what this is about. And it may be that God is kind of proud of you, and he wants to show people that those who trust him will continue to trust him, and they will survive. They will get through this difficult thing. And so that's this idea of God being proud. Third reason why we go through trials, I'm calling it protection, or the idea is to keep us from trouble. We also saw this hinted at in the book of Job in chapter 36. And it's close. Some of these are kind of overlapping, the idea of correction and refining. Sometimes God uses difficulties in our lives to steer us away from things that would bring us into sin. We saw this back in chapter 36 when Paul talks about this thorn in his flesh. He says in 2 Corinthians 12:7, and lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Paul had some amazing visions, had a vision of heaven even, and he's saying, God allowed this thorn in my flesh to keep me humble, to keep him from sin, to keep him from the sin of pride. A couple of weeks ago, my barber is out in Cerritos. Is that the city? Cerritos, way out on the other side of 91 in Orange Thorpe. And Tim has been my barber for 20, 30 years. And I was coming home from getting my hair cut, and I'm driving back up the 91 freeway, and I hear a bunch of noise. Just strange noise. And I look in my rearview mirror, and I see four or five cars swerving back and forth across the freeway, crashing into each other. Somebody hit somebody else, and then it just all went wild. And I was, you know, I'm about 200 yards ahead of it, and I was freaking out. I was like, oh my gosh, I almost was there. Now, usually I complain about getting stuck at red lights or why things are slow, why my haircut didn't get done exactly when I thought it should get done. But you know, that day, if I was 30 seconds later, I would have been right in the middle of that thing. See, sometimes God allows difficulty in our lives to slow us down, to get our attention, to keep us safe, to protect us, keep us from trouble. Number four, a reason we go through trials is to refine our faith. Peter wrote in 1 Peter chapter 1, he says, "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ." That word tested speaks of refining gold. God refines our faith like a goldsmith refines gold. And it's my understanding that a goldsmith will heat the ore up until it's a molten state, and he keeps on heating it, he keeps on stirring it. The impurities, the dross, come to the surface, and he will scoop it off, or he'll pour it from vessel to vessel to remove the impurities. And they say that he knows that it's pure when he can see his own reflection in the gold. That's what God's doing to your faith sometimes. Not because you're a bad person, not because he's punishing you, but he's refining you. He's making you better. He's removing even more bad stuff from your life. Charles Spurgeon said, "I bear willing witness that I owe more to the fire and the hammer and the file than to anything else in my Lord's workshop. I sometimes question whether I have ever learned anything except through the rod. When my schoolroom is darkened, I see most." Now, we've talked about my personal working definition of what faith is. It's trusting someone you don't see. It's trusting God when you don't understand. That's faith. Faith is, and that comes from Hebrews 11:1. And there are times when God will darken the room and you don't see what he's doing. It's because he's checking your faith. He's giving you a chance to grow your faith. Is anybody going through something right now that you don't understand? I got my hand up because I'm one of them. Okay? I don't understand why I'm going through this. Well, the room is dark and you don't understand. This is a chance to trust him. That's what this is. That's one of the things that can be this is about. It's drawing you out. It's showing that you can trust him. I was thinking in terms of this, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, Paul writes, "No temptation has overtaken you yet except such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it." Now, we may not look at it this way often, but the word that's translated temptation can also be translated trial or test. They're kind of interchangeable at times. And so we often look at this verse simply in the ideas of being tempted towards sin and that, you know, God will provide a way out of the temptation. But it can also be applied to testing, to the trials, to the difficulties that we're going through. Go through that again. "So no trial has overtaken you except such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tested beyond what you are able, but with the trial will also make the way of escape that you may be able to endure it." God is faithful in our trials. That means he can be trusted. That's what faithful means. It means you can trust him. And he'll provide a way to get through the trial. It doesn't mean he's going to necessarily make the trial be over, but he'll help you get through the trial because he is faithful. And because he's faithful, you can trust him. He's refining your faith. A young man had worked for years to establish himself as a peach grower, had invested everything in a small peach orchard, which bloomed bounteously. Then came the frost. He didn't go to church the next Sunday, nor the next, nor the next. His pastor gave him a call to find out why he hadn't been in church. And the discouraged young fellow said, well, no, and what is more, I'm not coming anymore. Do you think I can worship a God who loves me so little he will let a frost kill all my peaches? And the old pastor looked at him for a moment in silence, and then he said, young man, God loves you better than he does your peaches. He knows that while peaches do better without frosts, it is impossible to grow the best men without frosts. His object is to grow the best men, not peaches. Does that make sense to you? You understand what the pastor was saying? We get all caught up in wanting to have comfort and ease in our lives. But what God's more concerned about than your comfort is about you being a better man, a better woman. And you know what? There is no way to be a better person without going through difficulties. That kind of sucks, doesn't it? I mean, you don't like that. I don't like that. I'm okay that you don't like it. I don't like it either. But that's the truth. That's a part of how we mature. God is refining our faith. He's growing us up. Fifth reason is to show Jesus. What do I mean by that? Let me discuss this. In the story of Gideon, this is in the book of Judges, God used the strangest military strategy that I could ever think of for Gideon and his men to defeat the Midianites. Gideon gathered an army, and God said it was too many people. And he whittled them down, and he said there's still too many people. He got it down from 32,000 to 300 men. Sounds like those Spartans, you know, 300. This is the real deal. It got down to 300 men, and then each man was given a clay pot with a torch inside, along with ram's horn trumpets. And Gideon's men were supposed to surround the Midianites at night, and when the signal was given, they all were to break their clay pots and to blow their trumpets and to say, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. But see, the thing that got everybody's attention was when the clay pots broke, the torches flared up because they're being hidden inside the clay pots. You couldn't see the light until the clay pots were broken. Paul will use very parallel language. See if you can see the similarities in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. See if you can see the similarity to the story of Gideon. Paul is talking about difficulties, and he says, but we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. We are hard-pressed on every side, yet not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our body. For we who live are always delivered to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. Sometimes God has to break the clay pots for people to see the treasure inside. There's another truth that I think sucks. You know, can't you just like, can I just hang a sign around my neck that says I like Jesus? No. Sometimes you have to be crushed. I have to be crushed. For people to see us with nothing else but Jesus. I got to cling to Jesus. To show Jesus. That's sometimes why he allows us to go through trials. Charles Spurgeon wrote, When the green leaves decorate the trees and the season is fair, one cannot readily find the birds' nests. But when the winter strips the trees, anyone with half an eye can see them. In the same way, the Christian may scarcely be discerned amid the press of business and prosperity. His hidden life is concealed amid the thick and throng of the things of the earth. But let affliction come, a general sickness, or severe losses in the family, and you shall see the Christian man plainly enough in the gracious patience by which he rises superior to the trial. The sickbed reveals the man, the burning house, the sinking ship, the panic on the exchange. All these make manifest the hidden ones. In many a true believer, true piety is like a drum which nobody hears unless it's beaten. Show Jesus. And sometimes there's people around you that need to see Jesus. And until we are crushed, until we are broken, and we got nothing left but Jesus, and they watched that, so they need to know there's hope in their lives too. That's sometimes why. Sixth reason, this is the most profound one. You should take a note, write this one down. I don't know. This is not the end-all list, by the way. I'm sure there's probably 20 more reasons why we go through trials. But I got to say this. Sometimes this is the hardest answer. I don't know. God does have purposes in our lives, but he doesn't always tell us what they're all about. When Job went through the difficulty, he wasn't told why. And in fact, even at the end, he's never told why. A young boy, about 8 years old, was at the corner mom-and-pop grocery store picking out a pretty good-sized box of laundry detergent. The grocer walked over and, trying to be friendly, asked the boy if he had a lot of laundry to do. "Oh, no, no laundry," said the boy. "I'm going to wash my hamsters." "But you shouldn't use this to wash hamsters. It's very powerful. And if you wash your hamsters in this, they will get sick. In fact, it might even kill them." Well, the boy was not to be stopped, and he carried the detergent to the counter and paid for it, even as the grocer still tried to talk him out of washing the hamsters. About a week later, the boy was back in the store, this time to buy candy. The grocer asked the boy how his hamsters were doing. "Oh, they died," the boy said. The grocer, trying not to be an "I told you so" kind of guy, said he was sorry that the hamsters died, but "I tried to tell you not to use that detergent on your hamsters." "Well," the boy replied, "I don't think it was the detergent that killed them." "Oh, what was it then?" "Well, after I washed them, I had to dry them, and I guess the dryer can get a little hot, not to mention those hurdles that they had to do. And I must say, though, they did come out without the static cling." Sometimes, I think we can identify with the hamsters. And you wonder, is God the silly little boy that's thrown me in the dryer? And I can tell you right off the bat, he is not. He is not. We need to trust God's love, his power, his wisdom. He's not a silly boy washing his hamsters. We can trust him because he loves us. 1 John 3:16, "By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us." I want to read you a long quote. I'm not going to put it up on the screen because I want you just to try to listen to it. This is from A.W. Tozier. And, I missed something. Job didn't get answers. He got more of God. And at the end of the trial, he said, "I heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you." Okay, now, here's the Tozier quote. "A generation of Christians reared among push buttons and automatic machines is impatient of slower and less direct methods of reaching their goals. We have been trying to apply machine age methods to our relations with God. We read our chapter, have our short devotions, and rush away, hoping to make up for our deep inward bankruptcy by attending another gospel meeting or listening to another thrilling story told by a religious adventurer lately returned from afar. The tragic results of this spirit are all about us: shallow lives, hollow religious philosophies, the preponderance of the element of fun in gospel meetings, the glorification of men, trust in religious externalities, quasi-religious fellowships, salesmanship methods, the mistaking of dynamic personality for the power of the Spirit, These and such as these are the symptoms of an evil disease, a deep and serious malady of the soul. A.W. Tozer wrote that in 1948. Sounds like today. Sounds like today. God isn't beating you up. He might be trying to take you deeper. Let's talk about part two. Here we go. Surviving trials. A family from Long Island decided to move west. They bought a ranch via the internet in Wyoming and packed up three moving vans and headed for the sunset. Several months later, friends from New York came for a visit. When they knocked on the front door of the ranch house, the father answered. A hearty exchange of welcomes, the visitor asked him what the ranch had been named. "Well," said the would-be cattleman, "I wanted to name the ranch the Bar J. My wife absolutely insisted on the Susie Q. My son liked the Flying W, and my daughter voted for the Lazy J." "So what did you finally decide to name the ranch?" the visitor asked. "Well, we decided to name it the Bar J, Susie Q, Flying W, Lazy J Ranch," came the reply. The visitor looked around and he said, "Well, so where are all the cattle?" "Oh, them," the rancher said, shaking his head. "None of them survived the branding." So, surviving the branding. How do we survive our difficult times? Number one, you got to change. If there is some correction involved, and we talked about this isn't everything. This isn't always the problem. But when it is the problem, then you got to change. You got to turn around. Hebrews 12:11 says, "Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it," those who've made the adjustments, those who've learned their lessons, those who have turned around. There's a peace that comes from turning around. According to a radio report, a junior high school in Oregon was faced with a unique problem. A number of girls were beginning to use lipstick and they would put it on in the bathroom. That was fine. But after they put on their lipstick, they would press their lips to the mirrors, leaving dozens of little lip prints. Finally, the principal decided that something had to be done, so she called all the girls to the bathroom and met them there with the custodian. She explained that all these lip prints were causing a major problem for the custodian, who had to clean the mirrors every day. To demonstrate how difficult it was to clean the mirrors, she asked the custodian to clean one of the mirrors. So he took out a long-handled brush, dipped it in the nearest toilet, and scrubbed the mirror. And since then, there have been no lip prints on the mirrors. So if you're doing the wrong thing, you've got to change. You need to change. How do I survive the trials? Well, you need to respond. God's not trying to break you. God's trying to turn your course if you're heading in the wrong direction. Number two, look to Jesus. Hebrews chapter 12, great passage. We could probably do a whole sermon just on Hebrews chapter 12, the first two verses. The writer says this, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded," because the book of Hebrews is written to Jewish believers who are going through persecution. They're going through great difficult times. They're tempted to just quit. That's the whole theme of the book of Hebrews. They're tempted to just quit. And he comes down to brass tacks in chapter 12. "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." Look to Jesus. He knows what it is to go through difficulty. He knows what it is to go through difficulty. You think Job had it bad? You look to Jesus. He knew what was ahead. He knew that he would be scourged. Scriptures said it. The Scriptures foretold it. He knew that he was going to be betrayed. But he still went on. He still chose the betrayer as one of his 12. I would have kicked the bum to the curb long before. But he kept loving Judas right up to the end. He knew that he would be crucified. That was clear as a bell in the Scriptures. Psalm 22, nailed to a cross. But he did it. He endured. And you think you have troubles. One evening, Jesus sent his disciples on a boat back across the Sea of Galilee, and a storm appeared. The disciples were fighting against the storm, and Jesus showed up walking on the water. Remember that story? And before Jesus gets in the boat, he asks Peter if to come out and walk with him on the water. Because Peter says, well, you know, why don't you, can I come out too? Can we come out? Can I come out and play? You know? And Jesus says, sure, buddy, come on out. And Peter gets out of the boat and takes a few steps on the water. And Matthew 14:30 says, but when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. That is such a great picture. Because it's when he took his eyes off of Jesus and he looked at the wind and the waves, that's when he began to sink. And that's when we sink too. When we get our eyes off of Jesus and we start looking at what a horrible mess I'm in. I'm in dire straits. I've never seen winds like this before. And I'm walking on the water. Nobody can do that. I've got to sink. And then you sink. Of course, you're going to sink. Put your eyes back on Jesus. You may think that no one has suffered like you. Well, Job probably has everyone in this room beat. And Jesus has Job beaten by far. He suffered on the cross. He took the weight of the world's sins and he died in our place. And he knows what you're going through. He knows exactly what he's doing. He knows. Look to Jesus. Number three is to pray. James 5:13 says, is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing songs. When Paul had his thorn in the flesh, look at how he handled it. 2 Corinthians, again, we've already read this, but Paul says, and lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Now, messenger of Satan kind of reminds me a little bit of what Job's been going through, right? Because it was Satan himself that was sending the message to give him a tough time. And Paul goes on to say, and concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. It's kind of like the 2 Corinthians 4 passage. Paul knew that when he was weak, and Jesus is shining out of him. When you pray, God may end a trial. He might. That might be what he's looking for. He wants you to pray. It might be that God will answer like he answered Paul. Look, I can get you through this. My grace is enough. I can get you through this. And Paul found that even the weaker that he was, the stronger Jesus was inside of him. Number four is to trust. So to change, look to Jesus, pray, and number four is to trust. Sometimes we feel like those hamsters going through the washer in the dryer, right? You know, we want to know if we can trust the one who's our keeper. And of course we can, because he's not a little boy. If God is stretching your faith, then respond with faith. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 19 says, therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to him in doing good as to a faithful creator. The Greek word that's translated commit, paratithemi, means to place alongside. Para is alongside. Tithemi means to put or to place. To deposit, to entrust, to commit to one's charge. Trust him. Commit yourself to him. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were three young Jewish men who would not bow to Nebuchadnezzar's statue, even though they were threatened to be thrown into the burning fiery furnace if they disobeyed. And they replied to the king, if that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. So they trusted that God would take care of them one way or the other. Either God could blow up the furnace, God could blow up Nebuchadnezzar, God could keep us safe in the furnace, or God could take us home to heaven. We don't care how he's going to do it. We just trust that God will do something. And so Nebuchadnezzar followed through on his threat, and he threw them into the furnace. And yet they found out that they weren't alone. Chapter 3 of Daniel chapter 3, I have lost control. At least it's control of, there we go. Well, that's, let's see if I can put it back. No, it's hung up. Well, I'm going to have to point to you, okay, Robert? I'm going to have to point to you. No. Okay, go, there we go. Did I do that? You're up here. So hold, don't do anything yet. So Daniel 3:24. Then Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said to the king, well, that's true, O king. Look, he answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. They weren't alone in the furnace. I kind of have a feeling that when you're going through tough times, you are not alone. You might think that you're alone. Everybody else might have left you, but you're not alone.
Jesus, I just don't trust you.
You don't trust me?
No, I mean, I want to trust you. I just don't.
I have an exercise that I think will really help.
Oh, okay.
Stand here and face this direction. Mm-hmm. Now. Do you trust me?
No, I just said I don't trust you.
Right, well, this is all part of the exercise.
Oh,
all right.
Right. Okay.
Whenever I ask you if you trust me, you say, yes, Jesus, I trust you.
Even though I don't.
It's practice.
Okay.
So, do you trust me?
Yes, Jesus, I trust you.
Now, fall back.
Are you going to catch me?
Don't worry about that part.
Okay, that's the part I'm worried about.
You can do this, okay? Just trust me.
Trust you.
Fall back.
Okay, well, Jesus, I trust
Good.
You. Yes, I do trust you. I'm going to fall back.
Woo! Oh, okay.
That's great.
Okay. Let's try this again. Just face this direction and keep your feet planted, all right? Do you trust me?
Yes, Jesus, I trust you.
Now, fall back.
Okay, I'm going to do it.
All right.
I'm really going to do it.
Okay. Good.
Jesus, you really caught me! I didn't think you were going to catch me, but you did!
Oh, that was great!
That was great!
You're ready for level two!
Level two, here
yes.
I come, baby! Woo!
No.
Whoa!
Okay, hold it.
Oh, you know what? You're too close. You need to move back.
Ah, right.
Okay.
This one's a little bit different, Laura.
Oh, okay.
Stand here.
Uh-huh.
But face me.
Woo! Forward fall.
Okay.
I can do that.
Wait.
Whoa.
Okay. Wait for my signal.
Oh, right. The Jesus signal.
Yes, the okay. Jesus signal. Do you trust me?
Yes, Jesus, I trust you so much.
Good. Fall back.
That's awesome.
It is awesome. Especially when you do it.
Seriously?
Of course.
Okay, Jesus, I don't know if you noticed this, but there is nobody over there.
I know it looks that way to you.
It looks that way. It is that way.
You can do this, Laura. Just trust me and fall back.
Jesus, I can't do that.
We can do it together.
I can't.
You can.
I won't.
See, as he's trying to stretch your faith, he'll do it in steps. You don't start at level two. And you may fail a few times. You may say no a few times. But you learn to exercise your faith. You learn to exercise your faith. He wants you to trust him. He wants you to trust him. You can grow a little more in trusting him. We all can grow a little more in trusting. And the last one, I don't know about, you know, falling back when there's nobody back there. But that's because faith is believing in someone that you don't see. Last thing is to rejoice. And that's instead of complaining. Job didn't understand what was going on, and he complained a lot about it. We had to endure lots of his complaining. Complain, 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 gripe, 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 God's not fair, all that kind of stuff. And complaining gets us into nothing but trouble. Farmer Joe decided his injuries from the accident were serious enough to take the trucking company responsible for the accident to court. In court, the trucking company's fancy lawyer was questioning Farmer Joe. "Didn't you say at the scene of the accident, I'm fine," said the lawyer. Farmer Joe responded, "Well, I'll tell you what happened. I had just loaded my favorite mule, Nelly, into the..." "I didn't ask for any details," the lawyer interrupted. "Just answer the question. Did you not say at the scene of the accident, I'm fine?" Farmer Joe said, "Well, I had just gotten Nellie into the trailer and I was driving down the road." The lawyer interrupted again and said, "Judge, I am trying to establish the fact that at the scene of the accident, this man told the highway patrolman at the scene that he was just fine. Now, several weeks after the accident, he is trying to sue my client. I believe he's a fraud. Please tell him to simply answer the question." By this time, the judge was a little frustrated at the lawyer and said to the lawyer, "I'd like to hear what he has to say about his favorite mule, Nelly." Joe thanked the judge and proceeded, "Well, as I was saying, I just loaded Nelly, my favorite mule, into the truck and was driving her down the highway when this huge semi-truck and trailer ran the stop sign and smacked my truck right in the side. I was thrown into one ditch and Nelly was thrown into the other. I was hurting real bad and I didn't want to move. However, I could hear old Nelly moaning and groaning and complaining. I knew she was in terrible shape just by her groans. Shortly after the accident, a highway patrolman came on the scene. He could hear Nelly moaning and groaning and complaining, and he went over to her. And after he looked her in the eye, he took out his gun and he shot her between the eyes. Then the patrolman came across the road with his gun in his hand and he looked at me and he said, 'Your mule was in such bad shape, I had to shoot her. How are you feeling?'" So instead of moaning and groaning like Nelly, there's another way to respond to our trials. Paul, in 1 Peter 1, we already saw it, he told us to rejoice, because our trials are refining our faith. We can rejoice because of that. That should be a good thing, that your faith is growing through trials. James tells us in James 1, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." Our trials produce patience in us, and that's what makes us mature, makes us perfect, makes us grow up, literally. You grow up with patience, and you kind of can't do that if you don't go through trials. There's a story about a king in Africa and his close friend that he grew up with. A friend had a habit of looking at every situation that ever occurred in his life, whether it's positive or negative, and he would say, "This is good." One day, the king and his friend were out on a hunting expedition. The friend would load and prepare the guns for the king. The friend had apparently done something wrong in preparing one of the guns, for after taking the gun from his friend, the king fired it and his thumb was blown off. Examining the situation, the friend remarked as usual, "This is good," to which the king said, "This is not good," and he threw his friend in jail. About a year later, the king was hunting in an area where he should have not been. There was cannibals, and they captured him, and they took him to their village. They tied his hands, stacked some wood up, set up a stake, bound him at the stake, and they came near to set the fire to the wood, and they noticed that the king was missing a thumb. Being superstitious, they never ate anyone that was less than whole. So they untied the king, and they sent him on his way. As he returned home, he was thinking about why he didn't have a thumb, and he felt bad for how he treated his friend. So he went immediately to jail, and he spoke to his friend, and he said, "You were right," he said. "It was good that my thumb was blown off." And he proceeded to tell the friend all that had just happened. And I'm so sorry for sending you to jail for so long. It was so bad for me to do this." "Oh, no, no, no," his friend replied. "This is good." "What do you mean this is good? How could it be good that I sent my friend to jail for a year?" "Well," he said, "if I had not been in jail, I would have been with you." "This is good." We may not always see what the good is in our trial. But friends, if we are trusting God, we can still rejoice because it is good. You may not see the good now. You may not see the good until heaven. I don't know if you're okay with that. When you get to heaven, you will see the good. But you may not see it on this side of heaven. It's possible. You may wonder, you may be on your deathbed wondering why I never saw any good come out of this. You will when you get to heaven. You will. I guarantee it. I guarantee it. You will. We need to learn to rejoice. That's a part of the trusting. That's a part of the trusting. If you trust someone, you can say thank you. And with that, we're done a little bit early. Let's stand and pray.